Fucking Kit Kat boy.
Welcome to MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex slash fucking Kit Kat boy, apparently, and with me as usual is James. You could check out our website, themacguffinman.com, for our other episodes. We most recently posted Scarface, and after this episode, we'll be posting something about Primer and Upstream Color. At the end of that episode, I will say next week we will be talking about The Night Of. We will not be doing that because we're doing that now. It's a whole time travel thing. You'll get it if you listen to the Primer podcast. But yeah, and follow us on Twitter at The MacGuffin Men and tell your friends. All right, theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
James.
Yep.
We're back. We're back from the theme song.
Yeah, we're here.
We saw lots of extreme close-ups on details over string music, and
yep.
Now here we are.
Yeah. We're here to talk about The Night Of.
Yes.
The smash hit of the late summer television season.
Yeah, for sure.
I think this one, pretty quickly after we started watching it, became clear it'd be something that we're going to talk about. And as I kind of just mentioned there, it's getting a lot of critical love and kind of has some new things to offer. So we thought we'd talk about it.
Yes, we do like talking about interesting things. It's true.
And this is interesting, right?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, I was a big fan of the show. Yeah.
Okay. Why is that?
Incredibly entertaining, for one. It's unbelievable how many scenes they pack into an episode of the show, and it never feels like it's too fast-paced. I don't know. There's a real economy to the way that the show was made, pretty much every episode other than the first one, which really takes its time. But it's really impressive how many things they get through to you.
Yeah, I find episode one's kind of just an outlier in the way that even the first episode of, even beyond the way that the first episodes of shows often are the outliers.
Yes. Yeah. Because, and sorry, go ahead.
Well, it's just sort of I think I would like that on its own. if the show never went anywhere, I think the first episode is just so engaging and enthralling that, it's probably an exaggeration that if nothing ever happened after that, I'd be satisfied. But I think that one was so good in a self-contained way. And I think just got you hooked so well that the first one really can stand on its own.
Oh, yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, it ends with a quasi-cliffhanger, so you would be unsatisfied if that was yeah. as far as it went. But, 100%. And the reason that one, the pace is different and feels different is just because it's almost entirely from Nas's perspective, at least for the whole first half and bleeding into the second half. It is still even mostly just Nas. I mean, you're at the at least 45-minute mark before Stone shows up, probably.
Even as you said, we're seeing Stone mostly through Nas's eyes at this point. It's not when John Stone's off with his family or dealing with Dr. Yi, as we get later in the season.
Yeah, but like Stone's entrance into the show is probably the first scene in the show that Nas isn't in, right? Because
yeah.
the first things we hear Stone saying are not to Nas. You know, he's in the precinct for totally different client and just happens to see Nas on the way out. But and that adds this more hypnotic element to that first episode. And so we get more drawn into Nas's story, and the lack of a perspective change doesn't break our concentration on his story and allows us to remain engaged. And it's just really, it's really interesting. And the fact that it's the first episode of a TV show, we know so little. We don't know where the show's going to go. We don't know what's going to happen. And it's cool. And you're also just sort of feeling out the tone of the show, which is pretty impressive immediately, you know? And then it all sort of comes together. That first episode comes together when he's about to be released from the 21st precinct, and they just start doing the search as Box is talking about an unrecovered knife or something like that. And the way that all comes together is just, it's amazing, you know?
So. Yeah. And I think that could be a little too much in the hands of less talented people. Mm-hmm. Talking about the knife as you find it and pull it out, but I think the setup to it is so wonderful that it works just fine.
Oh yeah, absolutely. absolutely.
Yeah, I just mean with so many shows, I can't think of the last show that I've only watched the pilot of. I just think that it's so hard to make a good pilot, and that or not even a pilot, just a first episode. that I usually, if I'm convinced enough to watch the first episode of a show, I'll watch the second one, just because it's so tough to make a thoroughly entertaining pilot. But this show clearly did not have that misstep at all.
Yeah, yeah, I concur.
You said something earlier I want to go back to about this show kind of in pacing being such an achievement, because it's so kind of grandiose and big and also so concerned with details. And I think that's one of the greatest achievements of this show is, you know, it's not just a crime procedural where someone may or may not have done a crime. Let's go through a bit of investigation, then a bit of a trial, get an answer, and it's done. We're dealing with kind of, you know, bigger themes and political and social themes. You know, what a criminal justice system can do to someone, even just the treatment of Muslims in New York post 9/11, or America in a bigger sense. Mm-hmm. And just these three-dimensional characters that we don't often get in a crime procedural. But then we also get down to these super small nitty-gritty details and, you know, just exactly what order, you know, how you get into a prison, you know, the rooms you go through and the speeches you hear and things in the bus rides you take. And I think that balancing act is the biggest magic trick that this thing manages to pull off with such success. And that's probably my biggest takeaway from a show that I have a lot of positive things to say about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wholeheartedly agree.
Okay. Yeah. Good.
Yeah.
What else do you want to talk about with Night Of?
I mean, it's just weird. It's hard to figure out where to start because it's, as you said, it is a show that deals with details and, I don't know, it's simultaneously like this very post The Wire show and also, well, I guess The Wire sort of did a lot of these traditional things as well, but also sort of like very old-fashioned type of storytelling. Like a lot of metaphors are hit on pretty hard a number of times, you know, which is a very old-fashioned thing to do. But also, as you're saying, like focusing on the procedure and how there are no real good or bad guys necessarily. It's just that the system is a thing, you know, and we all have to live within this system. And I don't know, it is this weird sort of this weird thing that the show continually navigated, and I never quite figured out how something like could feel simultaneously so old fashioned and also so modern, you know?
Yeah. What do you feel makes it? Where does the new part of that come in? What makes it feel modern other than maybe dealing with some of those same issues that even if some people working in these institutions are good, the net result is negative.
The sorry, what was that again?
What is it that feels so modern about it then?
It's just the idea that I mean, you go to this conversation in the last episode where Box is drinking by himself and two other cops are talking down the bar about a guy that was consulting with one of those cops about making a television show, right? And it's this hero cop TV show, I believe. And the cop says to the other cop, he's like, well, I'll tell you something. What you should do is make a show about a cop that doesn't give a shit, just punches in, does his job, punches out, and goes home to his family. Then the whole job would be at your feet or whatever, you know, just saying that cops would really appreciate a show about what being a policeman or police officer is actually like. And that's sort of the way that this show treats all of these positions, lawyers, cops, anybody working in a prison. It just sort of treats all of them like people with jobs that would look at their job like a job, not necessarily like somebody from the outside would look at it, where we look at cops and just assume that they have to understand the weight of what they do at all times. You know, there's somebody that is living in that world and is allowed to get absorbed by that world and is normalized within that world. So they start to see things as just the day to day, even though something like potentially arresting Nas for a crime he may or may not have committed is like a real thing. You know, like that's a thing that people should worry about constantly. But when you have been a cop for 30 years or however long Box has been a cop, it sort of just becomes the job to put him away, as opposed to figuring out whether or not you should, you know?
Yeah, so a few things about that. I think, other than Nas, his family, and even they don't get a ton of screen time, Nas and Stone are really the only people who we see, you know, not at work. Mm-hmm. Everyone else is doing their job, as you said, you know, lawyers being lawyers and prison guards being prison guards, judges being judges, things like that. And yeah, I mean, that's, you're right. I mean, we see these people just at work doing what it is they do. And, but do you think that applies for Box? I mean, the discussion you heard at the bar of them talking about, you know, this is what cops are really like, is that they don't care. Do you think, what is it that makes him stand up and walk away from that discussion, that he kind of pretends he's that person and realizes he's not when he hears it spoken that way? Or what is that?
Well, the thing with Box, especially when that scene comes, I think it's the very first scene of the eighth episode, the final episode. When, you know, I mean, one of the things I like so much about this show is the way that we see subtle changes in characters and throughout the show, specifically Nas and Box. I think they're so fascinating to watch. But Box, you know, if you're watching that episode, it's also when he presents the new case to Weiss, or the case on, I forget the character's name, Shitbrick from American Pie, presents that to Weiss as sort of like he's starting to have these doubts, Box is. And he's slowly starting to realize that maybe he should have, you know, looked deeper before the trial actually started, you know. And I think the real button on that is the Weiss's closing arguments when she says that the police never investigated anybody but Nas, and then Box walks out, you know? And so it's just an episode full of Box walking out of situations. But, and then you sort of go back to thinking about how Box was in the first episode, and it's just, it's somebody that gets woken up at 4 a.m. and who has to go into work because Kevin Dunn doesn't want to start working on this crime scene, knowing that Box is going to have to take it over anyway. And so from the beginning on, he is going through this sort of just this procedure that he does on the 300 plus crime scenes he's been at in his 30 year career. But he also doesn't look around. You know, he gives Nas a lot of time before he decides to actually charge him, but he never looks at anybody else, you know. And I think the Box's, throughout Box's arc in this show, it's him starting to realize that, he gave Nas a fair shake, or at least a shake, maybe not fair, but he should have looked around a bit more, you know. And that's sort of, I think that's why he's getting up to leave, is because he's realizing that he might be that cop, and he wants to prove to himself that he's not. You know?
Yeah, no, completely. And when he's got his initial case on Nas, you know, his initial assessment of the crime scene, you know, it, this is an understatement, it doesn't look good for Nas. I mean, this isn't terrible police work to think he might be the one who did this. There's a mountain of evidence pointing towards him. And I think Box just feels that that's enough of a case. You know, it's a strong case, what we have here. It's not necessarily, I can tell you everything about how this night went down, but I have a pretty good understanding of who did it. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that comes up again in that eighth episode when he provides that evidence to Weiss about... character's name is Ray, I believe.
Okay. All I know is that Jim's dad would be very disappointed. Continue.
That's right. That this financial planner is most likely the one who did it. And he presents that to Weiss, who says, we have more on the kid. It's not, I think it was the kid, or it couldn't be this person. It's, I think we have more on the kid. Our chances of closing this case or winning this case are better with what we have right here. Yeah. And that's, you know, the distance that truth is put at in this show. It's such an afterthought, you know, in an institution that we think is about figuring out the truth of something and punishing or not the people responsible. you would think what actually happened would be the paramount, and that would be all that they're concerned with. Mm-hmm. But we see that that's ignored, you know, widely throughout the show. Jon Snow in the first episode comes out and pretty much says, I don't care if you didn't or you didn't. Mm-hmm. It's just about proving that you didn't do it. That's what my job is. That's what your only concern should be. And I mean, when we talk about some of the bigger themes and some of the ultimate, negative thinking points that the show leaves us with, I think that's one of the major ones, that the truth is so irrelevant. And I know that this isn't the first show to present that in a, you know, a criminal justice standpoint, but I think it just does a remarkable job of it. And it's very present, but it's not spelt out in a really ham-fisted way, and I think that's another strength of the show.
Yeah, exactly. Even though it is spelled out in Stone's closing argument, the fists are not full of ham, as you say it. Like, it's, and even just in the form of a closing argument, like, that's such an old-fashioned way to sort of make your final point. You know, it's the courtroom drama where the lawyer bares his soul. I mean, we talked about the verdict recently.
Yeah, it's Paul Newman in the verdict.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, it is just this very old-fashioned way that can go wrong so easily and has so many times, and yet the show just kind of does it perfectly. And I think that's a thing that is true for a lot of the show. They do a lot of things that would be so easy to get, like, just wrong enough that it becomes terrible. And it's not like the show makes no missteps. But yeah, it I don't know. It's an amazing tightrope walk for so many important moments of this show, and tends to not fall off, you know?
Yeah, even Nas realizing that he doesn't really have a close relationship with the truth or his understanding of how that night went, you know, when he's, I would say, mistakenly put on the witness stand, yeah. I guess, at the trial. And, you know, again, this plays with the kind of young person versus the older person when we look at Stone and Chandra. You know, if we're going to talk about them working this case together, Chandra is so obsessed with the truth and what actually happened, and getting Nas out there because he should have the best understanding of that night. So if we get him up there, and she believes that he didn't do it, you know, if we get him up there and let him talk enough, this will all get cleared up. And it doesn't go well, and it kind of comes down to Jon Stone's speech, which, yes, is very reminiscent of that speech in the very end of the verdict, which is, these institutions were made to protect people. They can be handled in certain ways and mishandled and hijacked for people who have more money or more familiar with the process than Nas and his family, who, you know, don't have a criminal past, don't really know anything about the legal system. They can easily get duped. But to speak to some juror and say that, look at the truth and look what you really think, and not necessarily what you're told to do, but you kind of what you believe is the right thing to do, that's what you should do. And that's, you know, it's tough to say that it's a success because we ended in a deadlocked jury and the case is just sort of dropped, but I suppose he gets the result that he was looking for, which is not going back to Rikers.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And just while we're talking about his closing statement, like, one thing I really like about the show is how, when, you know, there's not a lot of score in the show outside of the theme song that we've already referenced. But when,
which is lovely.
Yeah, it's great. And that's kind of the point I'm getting at, is that the score in this show is very old fashioned and very, very good. And also kind of not really the what would be heard as like a modern score. You know, modern scores are more sort of ambient at this point. A lot more synthesizers involved, and
shorter, I feel, too.
Yeah. Yeah. And the music in the closing argument that Stone gives is sort of the one time when there's this music that sort of feels more, I suppose, for lack of a better term, like of the Brian Eno sort of genre, where it is just sort of music that's just there. There are no definable instruments. It's just sort of this building sort of sound of grayness that exists underneath Stone's remarks. And the reason that's so interesting is because that's exactly what he's talking about. He's talking about the gray area, and the fact that they sort of choose this one moment to have this really this piece of music that stands so far apart from the rest of the show in that it stands apart by blending in entirely, you know, like it's a very interesting choice. And in a way that I haven't really, certainly not registered before, but I think it's a beautiful decision that works out beautifully. You know, like I thought it was really cool.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Soaring strings and anything too over the top and operatic would be so, antithetical to what this show does. And
yeah, like the music's supposed to underscore your point, which it does there, as opposed to most of the time people overscore it with the music, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think even just with the theme song, it's such a perfect fit because it always feels like there should be a closing note on that song. Mm-hmm. Like it kind of leaves you in this just the way that it's not perfectly symmetrical. It always feels like there should be kind of one note that closes things off and seals it up and gives it some closure, but of course it doesn't. It's what this entire show does. We never quite understand whether Nas did it or not. I mean, we're given a good alternate version of what did happen, you know, as we discussed with Ray and maybe Dwayne Reed and maybe the hearse driver. those loose ends. But that's kind of what this show does. It doesn't make a neat little package. We have, you know, what we can see being likely futures for some of these people, but we don't know everything that's good, that happens within the narrative, you know, from when we first meet Nas to when this trial's over, and, you know, the little bit after it's over. We don't even understand that part, you know, the part of the story that we were around for, let alone what happens in the future. I mean, I think it's clear that Nas is worse off for this experience, but
yeah, it wasn't a life enriching experience.
No, that's for sure. But you know, I think Box, we're left with some questions about. I think Weiss, we're left with some questions about. Chandra as well. Nas's family. You know, there's even outside of the, are they going to capture Ray or other things I don't really have a solid interest in finding out, there's still just a lot of things left undone.
Yeah, exactly. And I think my favorite sort of small thing that runs throughout the show is the splintering of Nas's family, like specifically his parents. Both seem to be on opposite sides of the coin. You know, it's certainly at some point, the mother vocalizes this. She says, like, did I raise a monster? So she's at least thinks that her son maybe did this, you know, whereas the dad never really shows any doubt. And sorry?
No, I just laughed. It's not, it doesn't have to be that he's 100% sure and he's 100% certain he didn't do it and she's 100% certain he did do it. I'm not a parent, obviously, but I think any amount of doubt that maybe you raise this person who is capable of this is bad enough. You know what I mean? Yeah. That's got to be pretty life-shattering. You don't need a certain answer that it's the opposite, right?
Yeah, exactly. And the younger brother, he never really vocalizes either way, but it certainly looks like he's in the middle of the two of them. You know, he might not necessarily have doubts, but he can sort of see why his mom would, you know? And yeah. That's one of the things that I found really subtly interesting about the show, because they don't like really hit on it, they just mention it every once in a while, is just the way that you know, this family that seems to, like, at least gets along when they're having dinner together in the first episode, and when they're having dinner together in the last episode, it's a totally different experience, right? Mm-hmm. And just the way that it seems like this whole experience just shattered Nas's relationship with his mother, you know? And it's just like, I thought that was an interesting thing that the show does really well by not focusing on it too much. You know?
Yeah, it's that, and it's her leaving the trial during at one time when she's really doubting it. Yeah. And that's enough. You know, I think that's handled well.
You can totally see where they're both coming from. You can see where his mom's coming from, and you can see where Nas is coming from, you know?
Oh, yeah, and his father. And, yeah, I don't think anybody in this show really acts unreasonably. I mean...
that's I strongly disagree.
Like who?
Chandra.
Oh, I kind of block that part out of my mind.
which one? Which unreasonable part did you block out of your mind?
The kiss, which is just should be excised from this show
fine.
Altogether.
So the smuggling was fine then.
Okay, yeah, I kind of forgot. That's glued to the kiss.
Okay. Well, apparently not, because they didn't find that piece of footage when they were looking for the kiss.
Those are two dominoes that bump into each other. Yeah. Did you want to talk about Chandra?
Yeah, she a dum-dum.
not really up until then.
And it's... I don't know. It's so difficult. Because, like, I was talking about this with the show with a friend of mine that was also watching it week by week, and I was like, what were your impressions of the finale? And her response was, well, you know, anytime I meet a manic pixie dream girl, I end up an addict sitting on the riverside just smoking crack or whatever. And I'm like, yeah, this show doesn't really reflect young women very well, you know? And that's not, you know, just, I mean, Andrea gets killed before we have a chance to see her become a character in any capacity. But it is sort of, it really sort of doubles down on that by making Chandra the dumbest character in the show, who is also kind of one of the most important, you know, and that Naz's life is in her hands. And I don't know, just some of the choices that they made for having her do things were kind of annoying. And it's not like the show is perfectly realistic at all times, because Naz would have taken the subway to Manhattan 100%, you know? Because, like, I looked it up. When you look up where Naz lives in Queens to where he was going in Manhattan, it's 30 minutes on the subway and, like, 20 minutes to drive. So for that extra 10 minutes, he's stealing a car. You know, it makes no sense, right?
Yeah, and you would think that there's a possibility he might drink at this party, and he doesn't seem the type to be that reckless.
Yeah, exactly. And since he's so young, like a 23-year-old in 2014 living in New York, he's also probably got a bike. Like, there's no way stealing a taxi, like, there's no way that having this car makes you cool, right? So right. It's just, there's just no way that is his first option, you know? And say, like, the subway's closed that weekend or the F train's closed that weekend or whatever, then you just put a line in there saying that it is, you know? So, like, it's not like this show doesn't have stupid things, but and Naz obviously does a million stupid things, but the fact that Chandra is the one that is the dumbest and also happens to be a young woman kind of makes it a bit more problematic, you know?
There's a few things there. I mean, she also gets saved by the older white man who knows more about her job. And I mean, it is John Stone. It's not as though it's just some dude, but
the John Stone,
the John Stone.
He's got subway ads.
Yeah. And, you know, people have pointed out it's another HBO crime show that can't really get underway without killing a good looking young woman. Who, you know, as you said, it is an issue of timing as well, as far as screen time, but who never really gets to establish anything other than she's a drug addict who, has sex with people and, you know, ends up being killed very quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it's not like there's necessarily like a magic bullet where if you switch the sexes of a lot of different characters, the show becomes totally different, because say, Naz and Andrea switch places, right? Andrea is the person that steals the cab and then a Naz ends up dead. Then it's sort of, it's still, there are still problems with that, right? Like it's the what if Will Smith had played Neo sort of thing, and then they would have cast an old white man to guide him as opposed to the white savior, right? So like there are always two sides of this coin, but I always feel like it deserves mentioning, especially since Chandra does like a couple things that are just unfathomably stupid for somebody that is a lawyer, you know?
Oh, it's so dumb for a lot of people, but a lawyer, well, yeah.
Yeah.
That's exactly. Why she has so she has to clean out her fucking desk.
God, I was so happy. There's so many people in this show that I was just happy to see, you know, like Glenn Headley is one of those.
Deep bench.
Oh, the bench. I don't even know how they could have this big of a roster without putting some people on the injured reserve, but they pulled it off, you know?
Yeah.
Like I thought, again, Ray/Shitbrick, I thought he's great. I've never understood why he's not in more things, because every time I see him in something, I think he's good. obviously, I'm a big fan of Box. I think Box is amazing. All of the stars of the show are amazing. I don't know which side.
It's Bill Camp.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I guess Jeannie Berlin is like the leader of the bench unit, and that she's Weiss, so she's got kind of a smaller role, but she's still very important. She's amazing. She's amazing in everything. Bodhi, I'm always so happy to see Bodhi in something. Yeah. I think his name's J.D. Williams.
But. Yeah, Jeannie Berlin's so good she can vape.
Yeah. Oh, that's so good.
That's how cool she is.
I have a question for you about specifically Bodhi. Why isn't Bodhi in more things? Like, he's so good. Like, he's so entertaining. Yeah.
Well, first of all, I'm just gonna say that he should be.
Yes.
I imagine he's constantly working.
Yeah, you know, I would hope so. I just want him to.
You could argue he should be in more high profile stuff, but there's I'm just certain he is working, so it's not as upsetting. And I mean, have we seen him play not Bodhi?
That's the thing. I don't care if he just plays Bodhi and everything, you know? Like, have we seen Michael K. Williams play not Omar? Like, I'm fine with this. You know? Like, sign me up.
Yeah. Oh, him on Trial is somehow a comedy highlight, even though this show has a lot of good laughs, believe it or not.
Yeah. Oh, and I mean, speaking of the deep bench, just the super creepy dude from True Detective season one as the judge, the trial judge. But I mean, that whole series of people getting people up on the stand in that last episode with Bodhi and the funeral parlor guy and I forget who, is it the stepdad? It's the other one. All of those scenes are just great. Bodhi especially, like him talking about the Duane Reade curse was made me laugh so hard.
Yeah. And pleading the fifth. I mean, it's
the best.
It's just something that, I don't know, I think is in a place where so many people have watched TV and have more exposure to the law and court through television than they do from actually being there, right? And these are phrases that you've heard but don't really have an understanding of. And that's something else this show does very well. You know, we talked about the details and the granular level that they look at a lot of this stuff at. Just the confusion of people in courts, you know, people who have never been there before, like Nas, how mundane and routine it is for the people who work there again, but how, just confusing and bewildering it is for people who aren't there, and the level of boredom, like the court is, it's like war, you know, it's a large majority just waiting around and killing time. Yeah. And then things happen so quickly that are so important and, have the implications that you're going to feel for the rest of your life. But it's mostly sitting around and being confused and bored. And to show that boredom in a way that's still compelling is just another one of those balancing acts that I think they do really well.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I feel like I've mentioned this on the podcast of when I did work in a courtroom for one trial, it was like 8 months, and I read about 22 books over the course of that trial while I was working. You know, like, there's just not a lot that you don't necessarily have to be working all the time. You know, it is, you're 100% right. It's just very mundane, and like one out of every 20 minutes is something you actually have to pay attention to. You know?
Yeah, and I really enjoyed, to talk about that line of when things are very important and very all encompassing of your attention to when they're not. And I thought such a good moment was Weiss just putting on her tennis shoes after the trial is done. She's like, okay, that's it. You know, I act and dress in a certain way because that's part of the job. And then there's this line and I don't have to anymore. So I'm going to put on some comfy shoes and get the fuck out of here.
Yeah. Yeah. She's the best.
Yeah. Jeannie Berlin.
Yeah.
We haven't talked about Jon Stone much, and he's pretty central to this show.
It's weird, like some of the characters that we haven't talked about yet. I feel like it's been the Box and Weiss show so far, which is right. Fine. I would watch that show. You know, I would love to watch a show about Box in retirement, you know, and also his continued adventures with Weiss. But we haven't really talked about Jon Stone, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. Well, we will. The same thing as. They do so many things that are so fun. Like they have some very funny moments. And Nas just doesn't get those. I think the performance of Nas is fantastic, but just the...
He's unbelievably good.
Yeah, the weight of the situation just doesn't... Like, I'd feel terrible making any jokes about almost anything that happens to Nas in this show, whereas Box's confrontation at the bar with Ray is hilarious. There are some things that Jeannie Berlin does that are just funny, because she knows it's funny.
Oh man, when she puts the photo down on the corpse when she's talking to the autopsy guy, like her, she's like, when he says just put the photo there, and she does like these like three double takes, and it's like Chevy Chase in the 70s. It's amazing. It's just this beautiful moment of perfect silent comedy. Anyway, continue.
No, that's it. I think that you know, those two have some fun things to do. They also have some incredibly heavy things to do. Nas is on the other end, where it's all heavy stuff, and we are going to see more of this actor. We've already seen a bit, but we will see more and more because he seems to be very, very good at his job, and you know, he has a very tough performance, but a very good one. Whereas John Stone has some of the heaviest moments of the series, and you know, dialogue-wise, some things that would be absolutely crucial to land, you know, like the closing speech that we discussed. But he also has some of the most fun parts as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's get John Turturro on the case, because we know he's capable of those things.
Yeah, exactly. No, he really... Sorry, go ahead.
How did you feel about his plot? I mean, he is... possibly the star of this. I mean, I think it still has to be Nas because of how central he is to the show, but as far as screen time, John Stone does pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, I would guess that they have almost, him and Nas have almost equal screen time, and Nas has him beat by a little bit, but I mean, I might be wrong, who knows. Like I said, it was a guess. Yeah, I mean, he's great. John Turturro's awesome, and like you said, he has these really important dramatic moments, and also has a lot of like real levity to him. Like, the appeal of his character, of Stone in general, is that he's somebody that realizes the world is a terrible place but is still willing to laugh in the face of it, you know, and still also has hope that it can be better. You know, it's sort of like I mean, the all-time character that's like laughing in the face of destruction is Peter Venkman in Ghostbusters. So like, he's got a little bit of that, in that he just sort of, he knows the world that he's in, and he just assumes everything's going to go to shit so he can laugh at it. But he also sort of has this hope that there is this this world where the hunch he has about Nas can be proven correct, and that a jury can back him up on this, you know? And yeah, like, I feel like we've been saying many, many times, it's a really, really difficult line to walk. And it doesn't surprise me that John Turturro can pull this off, but he absolutely does, you know?
Yeah. How optimistic is he by the end of things, though? I mean, how do we take his closing of watching TV on his own, having his mini beers? it's clear he now charges a fee, which is notable because that, you know, part of what he used to do and the way he used to advertise himself is that there wasn't a fee until they're free, right?
Yeah,
now it's $250 cash up front. Is that out of step with some of the optimism that we think is supposed to underline his entire character? Or is that a change that's been brought about by the narrative?
I think it's the latter, because like, when he's giving his closing argument, the what we're supposed to feel, and I mean, it's like you said with the verdict, comparing it to the verdict with Paul Newman, is that it really feels like he is arguing for, you know, the way that he wants the world to be, and that if this jury comes back with a guilty verdict, he like might quit, you know? And yeah. And by that not happening, by him doing something that he does believe that he sort of did something good for Nas, you know, and Nas thanks him a couple times throughout the show, and he feels like he did something good, so he feels like his service now has worth, right? Whereas at the beginning of the show, he's not sure that what he's doing for these people is okay, is good, you know. So he kind of feels guilty about taking the money sometimes, whereas at the end he's like, you know what, I'm a part of the system, but sometimes the system doesn't fuck everybody over, and so I'm okay taking my $250, you know? So I mean, that's sort of like I don't know, a hedging your bets sort of thing, but I think that's sort of where he's at. Yeah. Like, he's still a part of the system, but he has now officially seen the system not fail somebody. So even though it still kind of does, but not as bad as it could have, right?
Right, but I think that he wouldn't admit this to you, you know, in public, but I think that the John Stone at the beginning of the show and at the end is one that gets by making guilty people get free or making them plead into deals that might not reflect reality, but you know, get some of his money more expediently.
Yeah. Homie's got to eat. He needs those dumplings.
I guess so.
His pretzels and tiny beer, as you put it. No, I know. It's just that is sort of what I think we're supposed to take away from Stone, is that sort of he sees that he has worth. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a bit more, that's still more optimistic. It's that he can do, you know, I guess saying do the right thing once in a while makes it sound like he's doing the wrong thing all the time.
Also, he's in the movie Do the Right Thing, so I appreciate that.
That is true. No, just that there are times that maybe he can make the system work the way that it's supposed to in extreme cases, and maybe some of these smaller, pettier crimes aren't going to be the things he focuses on, but it's kind of that one big success and maybe any potential good success in the future.
Yeah, exactly. Like, these people are paying $250 just to keep them around in the system so that when a Nas comes around, you at least have people like Stone still around, you know?
Yeah, and I think the interesting an interesting part was his relationship with Box, because they seem like they should be, you know, just the nature of their work would put them at odds with each other so often. They seem like they would have a lot in common, and we'll never find that common ground and get along. I mean, they're both a bit rough around the edges as well, so maybe that's part of it. But I thought it was really interesting.
I think Box redefines rough around the edges. Sorry, continue.
No, I thought it was interesting when, you know, it's John Stone's being pretty sympathetic towards Nas, especially at the beginning. He knows nothing about him, but wants to take on his case, presumably because he just believes he's innocent and he's so much different than the people John Stone deals with on a day-to-day basis. Yet it's Box giving him Nas's inhaler that Stone really tries to catch him on. You know, it's this sympathetic thing to someone who he's being sympathetic towards, but just the nature of the competition and the legal system between them. You know, he catches him on that, even though it's something I could see both people doing.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, Stone say to Nas about Box? He says he'll screw you over just inside the rules. So he found the one thing that was outside the rules that Box did. And so he will get him on that, you know?
Yeah. Then another little thing that I enjoyed with Box is just when he was golfing and looking at that guy from behind and he sees, you know, someone from the videotape. Like, it's just so deep into who he is fundamentally that even when he's supposed to be golfing and relaxing, that's the thing that he sees. I enjoyed that.
I mean, Box golfing might be my favorite scene in the whole series. You know? Like, I loved it so much because it was so funny and so, like, so dramatic at the same time, and no words were spoken, you know? It's just a dude waiting to tee off, and they get so much across. It's just the economy of it was amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And obviously I'm being hyperbolic by saying it was my favorite scene, but, you know.
Yeah, no, it's good, though. No, and I think you're right about how much they've managed to get out of what on paper is really not that much.
Yeah, what's on paper is Box waits to tee off, looks at somebody who is finishing up their putt, end of scene.
Yeah. Continues to wait to tee off.
Yeah, exactly. Has to order Red Label now.
That's right. Yeah. You want to talk about John Stone's cat?
Sure. Can we talk? I feel like we should talk about Nas.
Oh, yeah, sure. I guess he's slightly more important than the cat.
He's slightly more important and also the same.
Right.
Yeah. So Riz Ahmed, whose name I don't think we've said yet, but who we are clearly both fans of, is so goddamn good in this show. So after I watched the finale, I was just like sitting around just wondering what the hell I'm supposed to do with my Monday the next week when I don't have a new The Night Of to watch. So I'm just like, oh, I'll just put on the first one again and just check out see if there's a big difference between how Nas is in the beginning. Because I, you know, you can see obviously he's changing throughout the show. If you finish the night of and then put on the beginning of the night of, you know, within the first half an hour, it's staggering how different the performance is. And yeah, it's amazing. He walks differently. He talks differently. He somehow looks 10 years older. It's truly unbelievable. And what you said about Nas having no comedic moments, he does. It's in like the first moment of the show when he says, "Did he say ex-fiance?" And it's very funny. And he still nails it. But like,
that's game.
Oh, yeah, it's so good. And just the transition that happens over the course of these, 8.5 hours, I suppose, or maybe slightly more, but like, it's so subtle. You know, he walks more broadly as the show goes on. And there's just this one moment in the last episode when he's talking to Freddie about how, you know, they're trying to find somebody to smuggle in drugs for them now that, Petey's dead and his mom is no longer an option. That new person that he interviews finds out that the new inmate is married, and he goes over to Freddie and he says he's married, so he can swallow the drugs himself. And he specifically says himself and not himself. Right. Nas at the beginning of the show 100% says himself, and that was such a tiny moment that is not like played up at all. Like, I rewound it to double check and make sure I was right. And and like, that's the type of detail that Riz Ahmed is getting into with his performance, and that, like, that language thing really seems more like an actor thing than a writer thing. I might be giving the wrong person credit, but like, just all of those little things add up to what I think is just an unbelievable performance, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, we spend so much time with the trial, but it seems like the central narrative of this show is the transformation that Nas goes through, and the way that we talked about the truth of what happened that night being kind of irrelevant to so many of these characters. It's irrelevant in a very meaningful way to Nas, who goes through this experience anyway and kind of becomes this entirely new person that we're talking about. And Weiss says, even if you didn't do it, you did it. It kind of giving him the negligence guilt trip, saying, you know, even if you weren't the one who did it, in a way that you're responsible. It's kind of the way that he's being treated by these institutions. Even if you didn't do it, you did it, in the sense that even if you are innocent of this crime, you're still going to live on Rikers for a long time, and you're still going to be treated like a convicted criminal, and you're going to be beaten and sliced and have your bed set on fire and have, you know, prison version of napalm thrown at you, and be essentially convicted in the press. We don't see him dealing much with that, but that's kind of more from the family's aspect till the very end of the show. But I'm going to say downward progression that he goes through, and, you know, we eventually still see him addicted to drugs even when he's gone out of jail. It's something that is just kind of one more way that the truth isn't really what matters, and it's what you have to go through while that truth is being determined that's really going to have the most important effect on you.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Oh, good. I'm so glad.
But yeah, just another thing that, you know, another one of those lines that the show always has to stay right on is just the way that, as a viewer, I mean, you sort of, I assume you had this experience. There are times when you're really like, oh, maybe Nas did do it. And times when you're thinking, oh, he couldn't have, you know? And just the way that we're presented with Nas, we start assuming that he's innocent, you know? The end of the first episode, we still assume he's innocent. And it's just, it's like, you know, the burden of the prosecution. They have to make us as the viewer believe that that he could have potentially done this, and or that he definitely did. Sorry. And yeah, and I think that the show does a really good job of showing Nas as this person that has done things that are not considered objectively good. And I think the way they're presented in the show is really good. And I think the way Riz Ahmed performs it is really good. And all you have to do is sort of think about, one of the things I like the most about Nas, or the way that they wrote Nas, is that he's 23, right? Where you're like, you're definitely an adult, but you're not yet fully set as an adult, right? Like, if Nas is 28 or whatever, when this happens, that's when you're sort of starting to become this like adult, that's probably not going to change all that much over the course of your life, right? Whereas Nas is now smart enough to be a fully functioning person as a 23-year-old, but also still youthfully optimistic enough that he thinks he can take a knife from a crime scene and it'll be fine, you know? Like, and, yeah. You know, it's just
he's still in school.
Yeah, exactly. Like, exactly. He's at the point where like he's probably just about to finish his undergrad, you know? And yeah. Like when you think about where you were when you just started to finish your undergrad, it's like the world is still like this oyster to you, you know? Like anything is still possible. And that's why it's really interesting that he is grabbed at that point where you're able to have such a high level of optimism, but also understand enough about the world to sort of be like a functioning adult, you know?
Yeah, and there was a point around the halfway mark of this show where maybe it was 4 or 5, but when we find the other murder victim that was killed in a way that's very similar to Andrea.
Oh, it's the very beginning of 7. It's the first scene of episode 7. Doesn't matter, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, there's that, and there's when he starts smuggling drugs into the prison. There's a couple points where I thought it was going to be, I mean, first of all, I think I already said this, but I'm very happy with the lack of resolution on this show. I think it ties into so many other things that are good about this show. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the show kind of presents it as a whodunit or a did he done it or, you know, how it all went down that evening. But then, you know, as we said, we kind of get into these larger issues and also these much tinier issues that are more important or at least more interesting or probably less explored than, you know, the X's and O's of a murder. And so I thought we were going to get to a point where it became clear that Nas was innocent of this murder, but it's kind of already too late in a sense. You know, now he's killing or being very complicit in the killings of other people in prison, and he's smuggling drugs, and if he were to get caught for that now, the murder trial would be somewhat irrelevant. If it was going to go into the direction of a fully pointed indictment of the prison system or, and you know, the criminal system in a larger sense, that if you can't even get involved with this as an innocent person and kind of survive it as the person you came into it into, then something's fundamentally wrong. And I think the show is still pretty pointed in its attack, but I don't think it quite brings it to that point because we never have this idea that 100% Nas came into this as an innocent person and now really is the monster that his mother was afraid he might be.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the show does a really good job of giving you potential options for Nas's you know, post the night of life in early episodes of the night of, like when Nas first is in jail, and there's that addict who is going through withdrawal and gets the shit kicked out of them. Like that seems like a potential Nas destination. And also Glenn Headley, when she's trying to get him bail, once she becomes his lawyer and she insults John Stone to the judge, that scene, she says specifically to the judge, like, where's he gonna go? He's not gonna go to Pakistan. He's been in Queens his whole life. And what she says is, you know, we're gonna put an innocent man in Rikers where he will become a felon, you know, an innocent man with no record, and what we're doing is just making him into a felon. And I think that's sort of the thing that we're supposed to still be thinking about in the 8th episode, is that he probably, like, there's a much better chance of one of those two things having happened now with the job at, or sorry, the episode that he's been through, you know. And and I think it's really cool that the show gives you a potential ending for Nas in like episode 2 and 3, you know.
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. And then the drug addiction, it's the visible tattoos, and just, as you said, the kind of less tangible changes of what he's gone through and the way he is, it's hard to imagine the person who Nas has become to be as happy and successful in, you know, the traditional sense, even living on the outside of a prison.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Freddie still made a proper convict out of him, even though he's not technically a convict anyway.
He sure is.
That's the most Omar line in the world. It was so great.
It's fantastic.
Yeah. Nothing more to add about Michael K. Williams other than that he's the best. yeah, and so to talk about the cat, just the rampant cat metaphors. So, you know, the idea that we're supposed to take is that Nas is a cat being put in with the dogs, right? Like, he's the cat that Stone occasionally gives a stay of execution to, right? Because after 10 days, he will be put down if nobody comes to get him. And he's not a purebred cat. He's an ugly cat. So nobody's going to come to get him. You know, that's what Stone leaves this this place thinking every time. And
we have the two similar scenes of Nas walking into Rikers and everyone yelling at him, and then the cat being walked kind of down the aisles of all these dogs who bark nonstop at him.
Yeah, and it's just this, like, this just very intense sort of, like, cacophonous sound of barking. And we don't just hear it one time. You know, we see and hear at that time. We also see it when I forget what happens that sort of gives Nas a stay of execution. It's not the end. Not the very end, but there's a point, and then something good happens for Nas at the trial, and then the next scene is John Stone calling to see if that cat is still alive, and the cat is, and then Stone immediately goes to pick him up. And so that's running all through the show, and there's a lot of talk of dogs in the prison as well. So a lot of animal metaphors, but the thing that I think really makes that something that is definitely positive for the show and something that I think they did really well is the last shot of the show, which I really, really enjoyed, because it kind of, I mean, we've got, again, Stone with his tiny beer and his pretzels watching television, and an ad for an animal shelter or something like that comes on TV, and he goes out to do his job, right? And so we've got this shot that's lingering on his empty apartment and lingering for too long, right? And yeah. Because we just know from watching TV, like, this isn't how long shots go on for. We know the show is just about done. We know this is probably the last scene. What is this information that's going to be given to us in this empty apartment? And what it is this: the cat walks by and walks from left to right. And that's the last shot of the show. And it's really cool. And it's like, even though Stone sort of has this, I guess allergy can't really be called a disease, but he has this thing that keeping him from comfortably living with this cat, and that's why he keeps it keeps the cat locked up the whole time when he does have it in the house. But at the end of the show, he's just like, whatever, let it roam, you know. And something that I found really interesting about the way that the show ties Stone and Nas together is through asthma and eczema being the ailment that Stone has, asthma being Nas's ailment. At one point in the show, Stone says, I believe it's really early on, Stone says to Nas that asthma and eczema are in the same family, right? It's just something that you've just got to deal with. And there is this bond between Nas and Stone throughout the show that's never really, like, you never really know why they like each other. They just sort of do. Like, they just believe the other person is doing or is right, or they believe that the other person is doing the right thing for them, you know. And there is just sort of this trust that exists in them. And I found that really interesting, specifically because they never talk about it. And that last shot is interesting because we're in Stone's apartment. He is somebody that works as a part of the system, right? And the last episode does a really good job of tying in things from the first episode to the last episode. Like, we mentioned the dinner scene, which is really good. We mentioned Nas sitting at the river by the bridge by himself this time, as opposed to with Andrea. And the last one, do you remember the last shot of the first episode?
No.
Okay, so it's right when Nas's dad finds out that...
he's standing outside looking for the cab.
Exactly. Outside looking for the cab, and that shot holds for a second, and then right at the very end of the shot, cat runs by. Yeah. And so what's really cool about those shots, what ties them together, is that the end of the first episode, the cat is leaving the family house, and at the end of the last episode, the cat is inside of this house that represents the system, right? So there is no more Nas anymore. Nas is now a part of this system, and he's kind of got to figure out his life by himself. And, you know, there are allies like Stone that exist, but in general, he's got a way more difficult life now. You know, he's got to sort out a lot of things that he never would have thought he'd ever have to sort out. And I think that's the thing that makes that cat and dog metaphor so good, is that, you know, he just gets out of this one place, but it has to be somewhere. And he ends up in this other place through some fault of his own, potentially entirely fault of his own, potentially not. And I just thought it was this really interesting place to sort of leave the show on, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that's a long way of saying that The Night Of is really fucking good. Yeah. even though it exists in a version of New York that apparently the show took place entirely during the New York blackout of 2003, because there are never any fucking lights on at any point. Did you notice that?
It's just so gray and black and gray. it's a dark show. Yeah.
There's a point when the stepdad and Box are talking in a diner. They're just in a diner and there are no lights on. Like, you can see light fixtures that just aren't on. And that's just crazy. There are no lights in this diner. There's a moment in the last episode where the lights in court turn off and it does nothing. You know, it's like and this trial is probably taking place in the winter. So the sun would be down by like 4 p.m. or sorry, 4:30 or something like that. By the time court is out of session, it's just insane. Anyway. Still love the cinematography of this show. It's just crazy that nobody turns on the lights. But
I will wholeheartedly agree with that.
I appreciate that. Thank you for standing by me, Stone or Nas. I don't know which one of us switched. But...
I don't know. Yeah. Guess I'm the cat.
Yeah. I don't know. Whatever. We'll sort this out. We'll leave it ambiguous, just like The Night Of would want us to.
Well, yeah, we'll have some answers by season two of Night Of.
Yeah, I don't think that'll happen. But yeah, be sure to check back next week or last week when we'll be talking about Primer and Upstream Color.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.